that time I was a delegate from the International Granite Cutters. I think, as I said before, that the most, not interesting, but rather embarrassing situation would be the Asiatic exclusion, which was formed, probably as a result, I think largely as a result of cheap Oriental labor. I think that the general rate for wages in lumberyards were around 25 cents an hour, and the Chinese and the Orientals were working for considerably less. And it got so, the situation became so serious that the lumber barons here were quite concerned about Norwegian, Swedish, other lumber entering the British market. And I remember being brought, they then referred this to the Vancouver Labour Council, thinking, of course, we should be interested in promoting our own industry. And I distinctly remember the Labour Party here sending a letter or contacting the British authorities to tell them that an industry that couldn't pay a reasonable, a decent living wage wasn't, as far as we were concerned here, they weren't concerned where the lumber went to Norway, Sweden, or where it went. Understand what I mean?
Yes.
So that was the situation. And ultimately, as I said before, the Asiatic Exclusion League was formed. It became the Trade and Labor Council. I'm not quite sure what it gave it its full endorsement or not. I'm not so sure of that. You have to check on your records. But I do know that as a result of that, they formed a political party called the Asiatic Exclusion League, and the leader was Joe Phillips. He was a granite cutter, man, a bald, tall man, about 55, with considerable ability, you know, executive ability, and so on. And there were raids on Chinatown. The Chinatown, this is unusual, perhaps, I don't know if it is or not, the Chinese they didn't put up with fight. They didn't offer a great deal of resistance. Poor fellows, they had to take it, and they swung back, and quite a few were injured with matches on the shoulder and so on. But they met them all together, different opposition, when they got up Howell Street where the Japanese were. And they realized when they got there, well, this is a little more serious. And so that later, of course, they formed then the Asiatic Exclusion League. I'm not quite sure, as I told you the other evening or the Tong, whether they pulled enough votes to lose their deposits or not. I don't remember how I voted myself, you know?
Yeah.
But that, I think, probably was one of the most embarrassing times in the early, shortly after the turn of the century there. And as I said before, later in 1918, I joined the fire department, and we had quite a job getting organized because there was considerable opposition from the Board of Trade, quite natural, I suppose. Thinking that it was quite a revolutionary step, the firemen and policemen should organize. But however, we became organized and was listed in sequence, I presume, of organizing with Local 18. And from then on, I attended there as a delegate from the firemen. And then, of course, that was in Bert Schaller then, and Percy Bengoff time. Harry Nealand was, as I explained the other day, I would say he got probably more seniority than I have. No, I don't know. I can tell you a great deal more.
Well, what about this Asiatic Exclusion League and if you went on these excursions to Chinatown?
Right. Yes.
Were they organized by labor or?
No, I wouldn't say that. No, they were organized, but as I said before, I don't think, you'll have to check on that, I don't think it got the full endorsement of labor to authorizing them to work on this way, because after all, it was law-breaking issues.
Yeah.
I'm certainly glad to think that labor had...
Were there trade unionists? Were there some trade unionists who were quite... organizing this.
I think they can safely say that 90% of them were trade unionists. Mm-hmm. It was one of these protest things, probably, you know, got up as organized without too much thought of what might be involved.
Mm-hmm. Were you approached as a trade unionist?
Pardon?
Were you approached as a trade unionist? Were you approached to
take part?
No. You weren't?
No. I was naturally approached to support the later on when they became a political party, yeah. The Asiatic Exclusion League. But I was explaining to you the other day, I was never quite sure of the, you know, justification.
So what made would you be able to speculate on what made Labour change its attitude?
What made Labour change its attitude?
Yeah, towards just specifically you don't feel the same way now.
Well, I think that the attitude changed as a result of organizing, and first thing we knew, there were Oriental delegates, a few sitting at the Trades Council, Japanese, I'm sure, I'm not quite sure about Chinese. And it was a gradual process of improved relations, you might say, between a better, a more tolerance. And the time arrived when there were Asiatic delegates to the Trades Council. I think probably that might have been accounted for. I'm just making a guess to the IWA organizing the Woods, or it might have been the Fitzgerald, I'm not sure. But, however, there were delegates to the Trades Council. Mind you, quite a number of years ensued before this happened, but there was a gradual, indication of tolerance. Toleration toward these men were, I think they realized these Asiatics were, you know, the victims of circumstances, and there's no reason why we should feel hostile toward them. They came to the country, some of them perhaps illegally, but not all of them, and it was a gradual recognition of people's rights, I would say.
Were you, do you remember the incident with the Indian ship?
Yes, Kamagata Maru.
Yes. Are you in on that?
No. I'm not so familiar to remember the incident at all, but that shouldn't be very difficult for you to get that, because there
are the matter whether you were involved in it.
No. That was, what year was that? 19?
Was it 19?
Thank you. I'm not sure the date for that. I'm only making a guess that the incident of the Asiatic Exclusion thing, I'm making a guess, mind you, I would say that would be, it might be anywhere around from 1909 to 1912, somewhere in that interval, that 3 years ago.
Now, were you here during the war?
Yes.
Do you remember the incident of the raiding of the Labor Temple by the veterans?
Yes, I remember, but I couldn't give you any detail. Right. No, I'm sorry, I couldn't give you any detail on that.
No.
As I explained to you before, I joined the fire department in 1917, and we were quite concerned. Our involvement when the big strike, the Winnipeg strike, when that reached the coast and became involved here. But no, I can't give you a great deal of detail.
Did your union take the position that you shouldn't go on strike?
Pardon?
When the general strike was discussed in Vancouver in 1919 in sympathy with Winnipeg,
mm-hmm.
What position did your union take?
Well, you must remember, we were just recently organized, and if I remember rightly, the Constitution stated it in its when its preamble or its objective that it was deemed inadvisable. If I remember rightly, it's deemed inadvisable to strike, and we didn't become involved. It was rather embarrassing situation, just the same.
Why, did a lot of you want to go on strike?
Pardon?
Did some of you want to?
No, but because
the treasurer,
because of being affiliated with the Trades Council song, we were wondering, you know, if it would reach that serious situation, you know, they would probably call everyone out in desperation. That's what we were rather afraid of. We, you know, sometimes it's difficult. You can't serve two masters, and it's one of those cases where it was rather an embarrassing situation. But fortunately, it didn't. With our involvement, they never sought it to ask, even to ask or request the family. Well, so.
Maybe you could talk a bit about the jurisdictional dispute between the Granite Works and
the Rockford. That is interesting. The Parliament buildings in Victoria, that must have been started just shortly after the turn of the century. And as I explained to you the other day, it's built of Haddington Island stone. Haddington Island stone, it's used here quite extensively. At the present time, I can refer to the City Hall, that is everything above the base course is granite, polished granite. And what's above that is Haddington Island. The same thing applies to the courthouse. What's above all the entrance to the courthouse, including the lions, are granite. And above that is Haddington Island stone. The Carter Cotton Bones had in that stone. It, as I said before, we didn't know what to call it. We knew it wasn't granite, and it wasn't soft stone. And when the granite cutters started coming here, after when they talked about building the post office and the Bank of Commerce, they were confronted with this situation. They were using the Parliament buildings in Victoria were then completed, and talking about using it in the court, this Haddington Island stone in the courthouse. I explained to you before, I think that Haddington Island is north of Prince Rupert, the quarry, the deposit up there north of Prince Rupert on Haddington Island. So this is another demonstration of automation, started then shortly after the turn of the century. The granite cutters to cut granite effectively, you have to use compressed air, pneumatic tool, and cutting through the column, for instance, you know, there's a 2-inch band, perhaps, and a 3-inch flute, and so on. Those things would be torn out by hand and then cleaned up with a pneumatic tool. Quite skillful. The same thing with cutting the bases or a Corinthian job of caps with a tremendous amount of relief. It is quite a skill. So the pneumatic tool was quite an invention. And when they talked about using the Haddington stone in the courthouse, they thought, well, we might as well try. McDonald, Wilson, and Snyder were the contact. They have a camp too on Main Street. You go in there, you can see the Haddington Island stone. You saw them used on Main Street there, yep, just there on your First Avenue on the east side. They thought, well, we might as well attempt, or rather experiment with these pneumatic tools. So they asked the granite cutters to cut some of this stone, and they discovered that they could probably, well, they were probably 20 or 25% more efficient by using the pneumatic tool than the old soft stone masons were, by using a wooden mallet, because a wooden mallet wasn't quite strong enough and effective enough to do a great deal of work on this stone. Well, it would do a lot of work, but it wasn't nearly as effective. Cutting wasn't sharp enough. So, as a result, there became a jurisdictional dispute between the two unions, the soft stone cutters and the granite cutters. They each had very capable executives here. They each were affiliated with the Trades Council. And it then, of course, meant that someone had to decide whose jurisdiction this Haddington Island stone should be cut under. So the Trades Council was unable to solve it, and it ultimately was referred to the Jurisdictional Disputes Committee at the AFL, and they submitted their findings, explaining that it was neither a granite nor a soft stone or sandstone. It was a hard lava caused by another refill of all kinds of eruption. There was no nature to it. It's a granite. There is a flat grain and an edge grain. Just the same as a piece of wood. There's no nature to this having been iron and stone. That's the consequence of that to be strong, but it can't be split with any degree of accuracy. So that's a fair finding. Well, of course, both unions were still reluctant to accept that, and they referred it again to get further confirmation to the authorities at Ottawa. The mineralogists, I suppose, it would be, and their report coincided with this report from the AFL Jurisdictional Disputes Committee in Washington, that it was this lava that I just described. And both organizations, they were sensible enough to work it on a 50-50 basis. They each have a constitution, you see, that the Granite Cutter said that they make jurisdiction over all hard stone in which pneumatic tools had to be used. You see, the Soft Stone Cutters had a constitution with similar provision saying that they claim jurisdiction over all stone that their particular mallet and so on are used on. So, however, it was settled, and I thought, when I speak to you the other day, it was a demonstration of the personal involvement, like throughout a nation, and that's going quite a long way back. And it took 2 or 3 years to get that finally settled. And today, of course, it doesn't make so very much difference, because the darn stuff is all sawn. There's not a great deal of cutting required anymore. So they said, I doubt whether eight or ten. Stone cutters or granite cutters in the city. I was, Mr. Gooderham and I tried about 3 or 4 years ago to try to revive the interest in the monumental yards, and this, of course, is outside. And we weren't able to, so they finally decided that it was up to the stonemasons, the bricklayers, the stonemasons, would be their problem to try and see what they could do with them, take them under their jurisdiction.
What year is this?
Pardon?
What year is this? What year is this about?
What years am I talking about now? 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, up to the war.
Right. And the settlement you reached was 50-50, yeah?
Yes.
And half the men would be recruited by your union, and half.
That's right. And then we had to permit those men to use the pneumatic tools, which we formally and considered was they had no right, it was out of their jurisdiction even to think of using.
You taught them how to use the tools.
That's right. So I thought it
worked out.
Yes.
And what arrangements did you have before the settlement was reached, while there was a discussion on it? What did you do then?
Well, it was quite an embarrassing situation. The employers here, the contractors, were decent people, and they naturally, they realized that the granite cutters were quite a little more efficient on doing this work. It was more profitable to employ granite cutters with the top stone cutters, you see, because of their knowledge of the pneumatic tools. And they generally wanted the granite cutters to get jurisdiction over. The stone cutters, on the other hand, by virtue of being first in, when the Parliament building was built in Victoria, were first on first here in the West, and they claimed that they had kind of squatter's rights, you see. They were a very proud organization, were very reluctant to give up these rights that they considered. We as granite cutters considered we were quite justified.
Well, what did you do? Did the stone workers work it until the settlement?
The stone workers, yes, largely. Yes, they did. And they took a few of the granite cutters into their union. So to kind of ease up the, you know, rather than a temporary settlement. It didn't disrupt.
Did you use the drills?
Pardon?
Did you use the drills then? Or did you start using you reached the settlement.
Use the drills.
Well, the pneumatic drills.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
You still right from the start.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. So we did it. They took 3 or 4 of us. I was one into their union, and we did all, you know, what we thought was right, and tried to instruct their men. They didn't take them long to catch on, you know. It was a matter of a few months. And they were able to adjust to the harder, to the pneumatic tool.
How many members did each union have at that time?
I would say from 150 to 200.
Around
here. Yes, it would be anywhere around 200.
Each of them.
Pardon?
Each of them?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Now, what's interesting is your jurisdictional dispute, you applied for settlement to the AFL.
Jurisdictional Dispute Committee?
Yeah, and this is the Canadian Labour Congress.
No.
Canadian Labour Congress.
No, we had there was no Canadian Labour Congress in existence then. I remember.
Well, there probably was,
but they weren't. We weren't affiliated with them. I'll put it that way. We had no other affiliation, but the AFL.
So that's naturally where you're applying.
Yes. As a matter of fact, the president of the AFL after the conference was, his name was Jim Duncan, and he was a granite cutter himself in Quincy, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. He was the president, and he was sent by. He was a man well respected. He followed the conference.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Duncan and. So that pretty well is the story. If they were sensible enough to sit around the table and discuss it, and there was naturally a little heated and embarrassing moments, of course, it would be. But it was, I often think of that now, as it was a real demonstration, wasn't it, of the first advent, shall we say, of automation, where where people had to readjust and. And that
were you aware of this at the time when the issues were involved?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. You mean that? Were we aware of the involvement of automation?
Yes.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
Now, what about the, I think we pretty well covered that. What about the organizing of the firemen? You said there was some difficulty.
Oh yes, that was
like the laminating that at all.
Oh yes, mind you, I would like. I feel in talking about this, I would like to get confirmation from the president of the Firemen's Union before I use it to. Gordon, the president.
Well, we can check it with them.
I would. I was like that. I wouldn't like to be too presumptuous or quote and give information unless they approved of it. As I said before, the Vancouver firemen, the local 18, were organized in that sequence. They were the 18th city in North America. And there was considerable concern among the influential people. When I use the term influential, I'm referring to the Board of Trade and civic organizations that it might involve. They thought it was quite revolutionary, as I said before, that firemen should become a part of organized labor. And there was considerable. I think, if I remember rightly, the first city was Philadelphia. And all over the country, it was the same opposition to it. In fact, it was too revolutionary the firemen to become organized. However, we were working here those days for 21 hours a day, 6 days a week, and executives that they had a little local union were doing their best to try and convince the city council that these were conditions that were really deplorable. Men hardly, perhaps they're exaggerating somewhat to say that their own family scarcely knew them. Maybe you can use that term, you know, talking to them. However, they were working 21 hours a day and would certainly need for something to be done. And when I said they worked 20 hours a day, they were at the fire hall for 21 hours. They go for breakfast. It's one group between 6 and 7, another between 7 and 8, another between 8 and 9. You come back for an hour. So they decided to organize. The International Firefighters had the first convention in Portland in 1918. Yes. And we sent our we sent two or three delegates there, and one was George Richmond, who became, was then nominated as Secretary Pro Tem, and he held that position until a few years ago. He was a Vancouver fireman. So he held the position of Secretary of the International all those years. And of course, there was no, as the years went by, I think the people at the Merchants Association, they surely saw later that there was no, they had no need to be so dubious or afraid of this so-called revolutionary step of organizing the environment, because the fire employer-employee relationship in all throughout all the years with the city council has been all that could be desired. So, but nevertheless, that condition, you can understand, it complex, shall we say, service clubs, local clubs, and so on, being somewhat so concerned about firemen becoming a part of organized labor.
And when did you get organized?
1918, yes.
And did somebody come up here from an international to organize here? Like, what exactly, how did it happen?
Yes. Yes. No. There was an attempt. They weren't exactly organized yet. Well, they didn't receive their charter. But the first convention was held, as I said, in Portland in 1918. Well, of course, we must have been organized to get delegates needed there, weren't we? I'm sorry, I can't. Right now, I can't think of who. It was done through the Trade Council.
Ah,
I see.
Trade and Labor Council.
Yeah. One of their delegates, or maybe two of their delegates, I forget who they were, and came and talked to the firemen and explained to them the advantages and so on. And they were also conscious of the deplorable conditions that they were working under, and they thought that they were doing what was right. That's it. Now, I can't tell you who they were, was it? Victor Midgley? Midgley was one, I think. Somebody else. But anyway, that's where it emanated from, yes. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't anyone came here from Washington or anything like that.
Well, we can check on them.
Yes, yes. Again, as I said before, I think that perhaps I would like you to get the confirmation before you go refer to the firemen anyway of their own executive, which I think is only right, Gordy McDonald, and you can get their delegates from the Trade Council, and you know they are. I don't know if they have the Trade Council now.
We'll check this.
But I would like you to. I wouldn't like to.
They may have more information.
Pardon?
They may have more information as well.
Yes, they have a minute. See, they got the minute right back there.
Right back.
Yes. So as I said before, I think perhaps if you went and saw Gordon McDonald or Bob Middleton, if you care to take their names, Gordon McDonald is the president, Bob Middleton is the secretary. I think it will be a little more authentic, don't you think? If you can have access to the minutes, which I'm sure you can.
Yeah. Well, just one thing now. To get recognition from City Council, what did you have to do? Did you have to go on strike or anything like that?
No.
What did you do? Do you remember? Did you have much difficulty getting recognition?
There was no labor code then.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, I don't think about that. I think I'm sure it was the result of a direct canvas lobbying with the aldermen. And they themselves, the Jordan, finally saw the advisability of giving consideration to what the firemen were asking for.
Good. Well, I think that's about it.
Would you like to drink wine?
Well, hold on.